Did you find that setting up a business that you're having to sort of learn things as you go?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I still do it now, you know. You're constantly just learning on the job, as the phrase. So, you know, me and Vicky were only, I was 26 when I started, so, you know.
Where did you come straight from then, from York? I'm trying to place your timeline together.
It was like Blind Swine with Michael O'Hare, basically.
Mm-hmm. And that's at that same location, isn't it?
No, so Blind Swine was in the centre of York at Swinegate.
Okay.
And then Michael opened there as a sort of really classic bistro, so it's steak and chips and snails sort of thing.
Right, okay. So if I think about his style and I think about your style, they couldn't be more different.
Yeah, exactly.
What attracted you to come and work for him?
It was the only good place in York to work. I mean, that's really that simple. I mean, it was up and coming, it was the only good place to work. It's the same stories, like right now, there's only a certain amount of places for a chef to work in York. So, you know, they have to choose very carefully, or you're going to work somewhere shit, you know, and like any chef who's working at any of the places which I didn't mention previously is probably working at a shit place. And like, it's just me saying it, you know, it sounds really rude, but like, there's no point wasting their time at some crappy place. You know, there's no point. I don't understand why you'd even do it, you know. If you just go and move to a different city, that's what I did, you know.
Yeah.
If you're working in the fucking Hilton Hotel making breakfast every morning, you hate your job and you wonder why you're not getting anywhere in your career, well, that's why. Just go and go to London and work, you know.
You've got one of the smallest kitchens I know in a professional kitchen.
Yeah.
Is it more important than that the person is right, even for you? You know, when you've got a great big brigade, it might not matter if one person's not loving their job as much, but surely you must need every single chef to love their job.
I mean, it's all about passion for what they do, and if they don't have passion for what they do, I'll just instill it in them. I mean, that's the way I work. I think I'm a really nice boss, and I think I'm a really nice chef to work for. But I want it my way, nothing else. And so
he's a really horrible guy. I'm just going to make a note on that. I've known him for quite a while. Yeah.
It's just like, you know, at the end of the day, it's my name on the line, and I want everyone to have a good time. So if you're not caring about it, I'll just make you care about it. And then it's up to you. Like, you're only letting... I always say to people, you're only letting yourselves down, really. Obviously, you're letting me down as well. But, you know, what's the point to do 16-hour days if then when it comes to actually cooking, whatever you're cooking, you do it wrong and you don't care about it? What's the point?
Yeah.
You might as well go and work at Wetherspoons and microwave it. You know, I find it so bizarre if someone's going to work, you know, 16-hour days or spend, you know, like 3 hours making something, and it comes to the day and then you just comes to the time you're going to cook it and then you cowboy it. There's no point doing that. You're just letting yourself down. You might as well go and do something else, you know.
I've seen you behind the pass because you've got an open plan kitchen.
Yeah.
You're not a shouty chef, though.
No.
So how do you instill that passion?
Well, I mean, I would say something like I just said. I just, you know, speak to somebody honestly and just say you're letting yourself down and, you know, why are you doing that? And I speak very directly. You know, if someone's doing something wrong, I will tell them right to their face and look them right in the eye and do so. And usually that will get the points across, you know. And honestly, like, the Kirchner Berg is a hard kitchen to work at. I mean, there's no other way because you're working with me all the time. I'm always there, you know. And it's always my way and I notice everything. And so if someone... I've had people before who come and work for me who want to do their own thing, and there's the sort of people who last a week and then disappear in the night, you know. That's fine, you know. I don't have any begrudging telling somebody that they're wrong. I don't... It's not about them being wrong and me being right, or me being wrong and them being right. It's my restaurant, it's my food, so I want it my way. You know, if you want to bloody have your own sling or thing, open your own restaurant. I've worked, you know, over 10 years to get to this place. So
it's true.
You know, I have the right to say so.
Do you hold yourself as accountable, or even more so accountable than these chefs?
Yeah, I mean, everything comes down to me. I'm thinking, in a way, it's always my fault at the end of the day. So if I let something go out what I wasn't happy with, it's only my fault. And also, if the team aren't performing the way I want them to, it's also my fault because I haven't made them work the way I want them to. And it does sometimes happen. Sometimes I might be knackered, you know what I mean? Sometimes I might be really tired. It's easy for a lot of people to just, like, look at, like, a head chef, like, over this role, like myself, like, oh, well, he goes upstairs in the office, you know what I mean? He starts a bit later than the other chefs and stuff like that. But when you've got the pressure of two restaurants, two businesses, you know, have to make money, you have to pay everybody, you know, you quickly realise, like, I'm definitely the most tired out of everybody. So, yeah, it's hard for people to, like, look inside a business when you like what I do, when they've never done it before.
Did you set out to be a business person, or did you just set out to be a chef and see what happens?
That's a hard question. I mean, I always wanted to do something with my life. I mean, I never wanted to be a chef when I grew up. I always liked food and stuff like that. I moved to Australia when I was 18 and like a gap year, and I didn't have any skills or qualifications or much of anything. The only job I could get was pot washing. So I started at pot washing and then worked my way up from there. So it's a, yeah, I mean, I'm really glad I'm a chef now, but if you asked me when I was, you know, 16 years old, it's not
what you're scrubbing the dishes.
And then when I became a chef, the only thing I ever wanted was to have my own restaurant. I mean, I will say that. I always was working towards, like, where I am now.
That was the goal.
That was always the goal. I don't see the point of becoming a chef if you don't want to do your own food in some capacity. If you don't want to have your own kitchen, you don't necessarily have to own it like I do, but I don't know why you would want to cook other people's food.
Yeah. There's different layers, isn't there? There's different levels of how people are involved. Obviously, so I've done the pot washing job. That's as high up in the kitchen as I got.
Yeah.
And it's a bloody tough slog.
Yeah.
But you can't help but be influenced by what's around you.
Yeah, and you can't help, if you're interested in food, you can't help but want to do more than just wash the pots. And that's basically where I started, you know, to get the feel for it, because I'd be given, you know, tomatoes to peel or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And just starting like that, and then you want to do more and more, and that's literally how I started.
Yeah, and it happens, and all of a sudden you've got a chef that's saying, hang on, don't peel it like that. If you do it like this, it's quicker and it's more precise, and you're like, bloody hell.
Yeah, exactly.
And then that's something that you can really transfer and take home.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it plays on you. Well, what else can I learn, and is that how it kind of happened for you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, I've always been quite creative. I've always, like, played a few instruments and, like, you know, really like music. Music's, like, huge influence on the food I do now. And I just got the bug. Once you get the bug of just cooking, you can't shake it, you know. It's also why Cochon's become what it is right now, because when it first started, it was 6 courses, a lot more bistro fare. I mean, it was like a tart and some ice cream for desserts. It might be a bit of protein, some vegetables, maybe a soup to start, things like that. But it was the constant strive and pushing, which now suddenly I have a very smart, I would like to still call it a bistro, but really it's a fine dining restaurant.
Hello, it's Paul from the Past Podcast. I just wanted to say a massive thank you for downloading this. There's more to come, so please subscribe. This podcast is brought to you in line with Great British Chefs. It's a fantastic website that I'm a member of. It brings you recipes, tips, and there's loads of features. In fact, if you think, 2 of my guests this year have been on the Great British Menu. They've got a fantastic feature going along with that this year, and you can get involved and take quizzes. One of the things I didn't know is they have a fantastic recipe guide. You can search from ingredients that you've got in stock. Or sometimes what I do is just go down to the market, buy one ingredient, and then you can look online and see what goes with it. And now, it's time for this week's podcast. On with the show. So, my guest today is Josh Overington. I've been fortunate enough to know you for a little while now. It felt to me like I was one of the first batch of customers through your doors. Probably didn't feel like that to you.
Yeah.
But it's the wonder. I say Cochon Avogul, so it's Cochon?
Cochon.
Cochon, okay.
Yeah.
From the wonderful Cochon Avogul. So I've got you here as a globe-trotting chef. You honed yourself in kitchens from Australian cafes to chalets to some of the most prestigious Michelin-star restaurants in the UK and beyond.
Yeah.
You took over from Michael O'Hare in your place, Cochon Avogul, in York. And now you're serving French-inspired food in your hometown.
Yeah.
So yeah. How does that journey feel from that very start that we've been talking about already, washing up pots, to now being this head chef at this well-established place?
Well, I mean, it's quite a strange question, quite a strange journey on myself. I mean, I had probably the most crazy career ever. I was a little bit of, how can I say this in a polite way? I didn't do very well at school. I didn't have much time for school or being told what to do. And unlike most chefs will tell you, of like, oh, well, I went into the kitchen and instilled discipline in me. and I had the opposite. I mean, I've always never been like told what to do. I had like a hard time growing up in the kitchens. And that's why, because I'm a stubborn little bastard. and that's what happened. So I've worked at many places. I had a very turbulent career, up and down, highs and peaks and troughs. But here I am now, sort of stabilised, doing my own thing. I also, as a young person, I didn't really know what sort of style of food I wanted to cook. So I worked at lots of different places. You know, I worked at places like Waterside Inn, pretty much to start, mega, you know, slick, you know, French food, Le Doyen, 3-star in Paris, to, you know, doing Pipe and Glass, you know, in Beverly, you know, pub food, to, you know, doing Le Langhi in York, recently closed, doing Italian food. I've done all sorts. I've done everything. And I've worked in Canada, Spain, you know, France.
I like this about you as this globetrotter.
Yeah.
So what I'm interested in is, why did French food stick?
Well, French food stuck because eventually, after I moved about a lot, I thought I'd better actually train.
I might as well try and find a proper job now.
Well, I was working at like Waterside Inn, and I basically realised I wasn't as good as I like to think I was. So I found it quite hard with the knife skills and just certain like actually basic techniques and how to make a souffle and stuff like that. I had no idea, you know. So bizarrely, I went for a 3-star, but then I thought, well, if I wanted to learn how to properly cook, I'll go to Paris. And so I like traveling. I think it's a really important thing for chefs to do. And so I thought, well, I'll go to Paris and I'll go to Cordon Bleu, and that's what I'll do. And so I went to Paris, Cordon Bleu, not a word of French to my name, and then sat in lessons where it's completely in French and sort of like taught myself a little bit of French. And then I realized,
English to French dictionary. Yeah. Hang on a minute.
And then Paris had a massive influence on me. I mean, it still does to this day. I mean, I go about twice every year to visit the sea. And it had a massive impact with me because you have the 3-stars, you have some of the best restaurants in the world, but you also have the bistro culture, which, you know, is exploded in the last 10 years. And then the produce, and just constantly around food all the time, it had a massive, huge impact on me. And so since that point of once I went to Cordon Bleu, I always knew that my roots would always be in French cooking, but then obviously with little twists here and there. And then, so my foundation's always on French food, but then, you know, I take influences from everywhere else on top of that.
Since I've known your restaurant and known yourself, it feels to me that it's developed, and now obviously you've got this place where we're sat today, so we're in your wine bar today.
Yeah, yeah.
Is development at the heart of everything that you do?
Yeah, it's actually, I don't like to use the word development. I like to use the word epiphanies of certain stages in my career, by going, oh, well, actually, and often it's going to eat over people's places or something. You go, oh, God, that they're actually doing this and they're doing that. You know, you eventually realise the older you get, the more confident you get on your food. So, you know, it came more about finding the produce and doing very little to it than thinking of dishes and then trying to cook them. So now what we do is, opposed to when we very first started, it was, I want to make a version of coq au vin or, you know, duck à l'orange, and then we'd do a spin on it. That's how my brain worked. Now how it is like, I work directly with farms and directly with butchers and fishmongers, and they'll ring me and go, I've got these beautiful hand-dyed scallops, I'll give you that, or, you know, asparagus is coming in, or, you know, there's a piece of cabbage coming in today. And that's how it now works. It actually works off now. I work directly with a guy called Ken Holland to start. He's a vegetable producer just outside of Newcastle, and he works with James Closer, Raby Hunt, and Tommy Banks. And he was a massive influence for me. And so what he does, he sends me 2 boxes of vegetables every week, and we now work the menu of vegetables first and then protein after, which is great. So it allows us to serve food which isn't necessarily best that season, it's best that day. So doesn't matter, asparagus is best that day, not best that season, best that day, and it's made a huge difference to what we do.
So I follow you on your Twitter and your Facebook, and it seems like the produce is the most important thing.
Yeah, it is, yeah. I mean, there's obviously, like, eating out at James Place Raven Hunt was a big influence of, like, when I first ate there. It's all about produce, but yeah. Very little to it. Lake Road Kitchen in Cumbria, eating James Cross's food there. And it was a very similar setup. And just how effortless his food was, because he didn't need to do a lot to it, which, you know, and I wanted to be like that. And I feel now that we really do embrace produce. And that's not necessarily local. I have this really fucking pet hate of, like, people going, oh, well, everything's local. Well, that's great. Well, your local strawberries, you know, still taste like shit because it's freezing cold. Or local tomatoes. My tomatoes from Spain taste better than yours because they're from a hot climate, you know. So, you know, I have a pet hate of that.
So, if you're a local strawberry farmer from the York area and you want to get in touch with Josh, you can give him a call. Look,
if your strawberries are great, then I'll serve them, you know. Like, I use local asparagus from Sandhurst because it's great. But, like, if you're, like, trying to spout off to me that, you know, your tomatoes are amazing in Yorkshire, then you're talking nonsense. It's not true, you know. I know it's not true because I've lived here and I've walked to the rain to work every day for the last 6 months. So don't lie to me and say that you've got these delicious strawberries.
I completely agree. Mm. I think as long as the ingredients are right, you as the chef, your job is made that much easier.
Yeah, my job as a chef is not to promote Yorkshire. Promote Yorkshire by having one of the best restaurants in Yorkshire here in York. That's how I promote it. I don't need to then use everything from Yorkshire, you know, and get my knives made by some guy down the road. You know? It's just basically...
You're not a local government. You're not about putting money back into the economy. Yeah. You're a restaurant.
People frown at me when I have this conversation. People, like, I've had this conversation at dinner parties before, and people go, oh, well, why don't you use that? Well, and it's like, well, why don't you use local cheeses? Well, because I don't like them. That's why.
Is that a moot point then when you're meeting with your friend Tommy Banks, who's very much, it's of his farm, it's of his land? Do you sit around and have debates about that?
Yeah, I mean, me and Tommy can have, you know, that's good because he has a completely different style and restaurant to me. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, oh, I'm not going to use lemons because, you know, they don't grow here. All right. Well, I'm going to use lemons because I live in a city and I can get hold of them.
Yeah, I live in, you know, the big city in the North York.
I think stuff like that's stupid. It's like, oh, well, I'm not going to... Well, the salt doesn't come from around here either. You're not going to use that either. So it's like... it's just like, well, I just think that it becomes a point of where you have to go. It's about the customer. You can have an ethos. I have an ethos behind what I do, which is like the produce. And like Tommy has an ethos. It's all about growing his own. And that's great. But cooking is cooking, good food is good food, and, you know, it's, you have to have an ethos behind what you do, and that's great, but, you know, I also am allowed to disagree with people, and I have a strong opinion on everything, so I guess that's my opinion.
I've obviously done my research today, but some of the questions that I'm going to ask have come from my memories of having eaten in your place, so if I'm slightly wrong, please correct me. One of the things I remember when you first started is you had this changing menu. I think it would change every couple of weeks.
Yeah.
It would never be fixed. It was always led by that produce.
Yeah.
Is there anything about having a fixed menu that frightens you, or is it the fact that, well, if in 2 weeks' time the produce comes in for that dish and it's not as good, I'm not comfortable in serving it?
It makes it difficult. So now how it works, the menu changes every day. It literally does change every day. Some things might be on for a month, 2 weeks, something that a lot of dishes, especially the fish, changes every single day because I usually buy fish, you know, fresh every day. At the start, it was really difficult because then you're sort of finding your own style, sort of finding who you are as a cook, and you're sort of experimenting a little bit and freeballing. So it's really difficult now. And now it's a lot easier because I have a repertoire of dishes which I fall back on. So if turnips come in, like we did yesterday, do a turnip dish. You know, beetroots come in, you know, I'll do some squab or some duck.
You've got the bankers in the back of your mind.
Exactly.
So
it's not that difficult now, but I think we'll say, like, back in the day, the first 2 years was...
When you're forming that must be seat-of-your-pants stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly didn't really know what I was doing. I never really ran a kitchen like that before, so I just sort of was doing... Well, I was by myself, so... I didn't have anyone to tell me no, so I just sort of did whatever I wanted. I might see, I got influences from everywhere, you know, and I just did whatever I wanted every single day. And some of it worked and some of it didn't. It's why that when we first opened, it didn't look anything like it did now. It looked checkered floor, a lot more bistro style. It didn't mean that it was a bad experience, but it was nowhere near as polished as what it is right now. It definitely was a bistro back then, and now it's definitely a restaurant.
I wondered if there was something around sitting still that you didn't like. If you've got an ever-developing restaurant, ever-developing menu.
I don't like restaurants will do the same menu a lot all the same time. I mean, because that's just boring cooking to me. And like, how can I say that? I fell into the trap a few times in my career when I've had the restaurants of where I've kept the same dish on over and over. And that's because I've created the 10 dish. And, you know, let's just be honest about it. I've gone, oh, well, you know, if like an inspector or some description came in or a reviewer came in, I know that's a 10 dish and I don't need to worry about it.
Yeah, and that's a crowd pleaser. So if someone comes in.
But I realised how boring that was, and I realised how boring it was for the staff, and I realised that, you know, that wasn't a creative expression of what I wanted to do. And yes, there are some things that will stay on the menu always, but they're on the menu for the experience now of the menu. So the main dishes always change, but there's certain things like the black pudding macaroon and the arpeggio.
Which, by the way, is amazing. I love that. Honestly, sometimes I sit there and I'll have a little daydream about that black pudding macaroon.
I think I should sell them a little
Oh my God, if you did, I would be there. I would be queuing outside.
Well, exactly. So certain things like that will always stay. But I never wanted to stay stagnant again now, so I'll constantly change it. I do have those 10 dishes in the bag.
You can wheel those out, though, as and when you please.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when I come in.
Yeah, exactly.
How have you found, then, coming up with a menu? And this is a fixed... I've asked you, basically, to create 5 dishes that sum up your career.
Yeah.
How have you found that, knowing that that's going to stay unless we do another podcast?
Well, I feel pretty pleased with it, because basically these are all memories. So of my all memories of dishes I've had through, you know, the last 20 years, which have had a massive impact on what I do today. And so I'm looking at it now thinking, I can remember all those memories. It's about memories, you know. I might go back and have one of those dishes and they might not be as good, but the memory is more powerful than the actual probably experience.
I heard this interview of Heston Blumenthal, and he talks very much about time and place.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you can be on a river in the south of France drinking wine, come back and you're in a grey dismal flat in Leeds city centre and the wine tastes completely different.
Yeah, well, that's so true. I mean, that's why, as well, is one of the things what clicks with Cochon is that it's about the whole thing, it's about the experience. So people then, I think what we do now is a complete package. But, you know, whereas before it might have been, you know, just about the food and, you know, good service with my partner Vicky doing it. But I think now it's a complete thing when you come in and eat, and it makes the difference. So I think people really remember us now, if that makes sense. I think people really remember the meal. Especially like in the last year, what I've done, where I've got a lot of press and a lot of, you know, hype behind what I do, is because I think people come in and like remember the whole experience as a whole, rather than, oh, I went to Cochon and I had this really good steak this time. I think people now go, I went to Cochon and the whole thing was just absolutely mad and crazy and delicious, I think.
Tell me then about your first dish. We've kind of been talking about this before the mics went live.
Yeah. So the first dish is Mills Marinière, and in Oslo Harbour, and I was on holiday, and I actually was, you know, I must have been about 10 or something like that, but I put it down, one, because of my love of mussels, and it usually features on the menu, but two, it showed me how good produce could be. It was the first time I ate something which, like, blew me away. I was there with my granddad on the harbour, and he would keep the mussels down on a rope, down into the water, and then when you ordered it, he would pull the mussels up out of the water, and cook them there straight on the harbour.
Amazing.
Give them to you.
So you couldn't get much fresher.
Yeah, exactly. I can remember I had 2 portions of it. It was that incredible to me. Like, it was like sort of a revelation. Most of these things, these dishes are revelation moments where I've eaten something and gone, whoa. And so this was the first one where I was a kid and I ate it. And once again, time and place on the harbour and the sea, eating these mussels, you know what I mean? And like, you know, in a foreign place, very exciting. And it was the first time where I saw how exciting food could be.
Yeah. I think we all have someone in our lives. I can talk about my nan until my heart's content, who gave me my passion for food. Your granddad is somebody who's just brought up in that little anecdote there, and he's also on your website description.
Yeah.
Was he the person who very much introduced you into food?
Yeah. Well, my family is extremely foodie. I mean, I'm very, very lucky. I think I have quite a good palate because of that. My granddad probably gave me my greed of food. I'm very greedy. But yeah, he basically, and I have it to a certain extent, Mickey will tell you, I do not accept crap food ever. So that comes down to eating at home, eating in a cafe, eating everywhere. I think life's too short to eat crap food. So I've always been instilled by my granddad and my family as a whole that never to accept subpar, because, well, it even comes down like, if someone put cream in spaghetti carbonara, it would upset me to a point I can't describe. To a point of, and this has happened at the restaurant, if someone makes carbonara, the staff, one of the chefs, makes carbonara and puts cream in it, I refuse to eat it. And I have a cheese board instead. That's a true story of what happened to one staff party.
So is not everybody petrified to cook for you then?
No, because if you made me a lasagna, I would quite happily eat it and be very happy. But there's certain rules in life of food, you know. I mean, putting cream in carbonara is one of them. That's just wrong, you know. You know, God does not want you to put cream in carbonara. It's wrong. You know, like cutting your burger in half. Who does that? It's in the perfect form there, you know. Don't cut it in half. It doesn't need to be cut in half. Stuff like that. People with chips and curry, you know what I mean?
Have you got the Josh Overington Ten Commandments or something like that?
If I write a cookbook, I'm going to have like a list of commandments. Like,
oh, that would be great.
It would be a good, like, yeah. I'll just lay it out that someone's going
to
do it.
How to please Josh.
Tommy Banks is writing the book right now, so it's going to be straight in.
Right, well, he's not. If he's listening somehow, that's intellectual property is registered to you.
But yeah, I think there's certain, like, especially when it comes to simple foods, there's certain rules that you have to abide by.
Who does the cooking at home then?
I do. Vicky gets too stressed to cook for me. But she picks the wine, so it's fine. So.
Well, that I guess that's how it works, isn't it? Because you've got two different people. One's passionate about food, one passionate about wine, so you come together as quite a...
I will say she's a fantastic cook, by the way. She is a fantastic cook.
Just in case she comes
in. She knows how pedantic I am, so she prefers not to.
Do you have stages then? Do you have little mental checklists when you're serving a food to a guest? Say, right, it has to meet this, 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 and this.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about touch and feel. That's how I would say. So, we've got the spring lamb on right now, for obvious reasons, just coming to season. That's what we had on last night. When we're cooking that bit of spring lamb, it's all about touch and feel. You know, that's all it's about, what the temperature is at. And we probe things for EHO reasons, but mostly, like, it's all about with my hands. I cook constantly with my hands. When it's in the pan, I turn things with my hands and stuff like that, and I have to constantly squeeze it. It's about touch and feel. You know, you can fucking, like, time things, you can probe things as much as you want, but it's not going to change the fact that your hands are your biggest asset, you know, as a chef, you know, and use everything about it. It's all about temperature and, you know, the feel of everything.
It seems to me that's more natural. You know, anybody can put a probe in and say, right, well, when it hits 8, it's cooked. You know, I'm just...
Every piece of fish
that's
is
natural, isn't it?
Every piece of fish is different, every vegetable is different, you know, every piece of meat is different. So one piece of meat might be for one animal, the other one might be for another, you know. So, you know, those two animals might have, like, grown up in completely different ways. You don't know, you know. And so... treat it like that. It's all about, you know, complete respect for the ingredients at the end of the day. And that's real cooking knowledge. You know, recipes don't mean anything. Cooking knowledge is about that. So a really good way for my chefs to learn is the sourdough bread, which I put a lot of time into. And I don't let them time it. I make them do it everything by hand. I don't let them... So we don't shape it in a baratone. We shape it all by hand. And we prove it. Everything is by touch with the bread.
But it's things like that that make the restaurant, isn't it? Because you know that as a customer, you've come in and somebody's made this by hand, they've shaped this by hand.
Exactly, and it gives us an identity. Because what I say is that it's very hard to describe my cuisine. So it's just a portion of the, you know, Joshua Overton cuisine. That's what it is. It's not nothing else. You know, it's not French food. When people say it's French food, it's not really French food. It's... Kitchen of the group, that's what it is. And when you have, you know, someone like me who's there every day, that's what you want. You want to sort of understand me when you eat my menu, you know.
Do you feel a different level of pressure then? Because, you know, if you on a day and you're sick, that restaurant doesn't open.
Well, it does, but, you know, I've only taken like 2 sick days since it's been open. And then it's the hardest thing to let go. I think that's probably the easiest way to describe it. To let go is the hardest way. The boys who are cooking at the restaurant are more than capable of doing it. And I'm more than capable of leaving them to do it.
Are you sure?
I just don't want to. I've said earlier, this thing, you know, I don't like doing nothing. I don't like doing so.
So you, a little bit earlier, talking to me that you're going to have a little holiday coming up to go and eat out.
Yeah.
Is the restaurant going to stay open?
Yeah, it'll stay open. But I will limit bookings. That's what I'll do. So instead of doing 30, we'll probably limit it to, you know, 15 people.
And you mentioned that you'll be back by like a Friday. Yes, so you're kind of back by the peak day. Is that always in your head? Or?
Yeah. I couldn't leave them on Friday and Saturday. The restaurant is constantly bound to me because there's no way I can ever leave it. It's an awful fact of it. I can't ever leave it. And if I'm not there, since the cuisine's so personal to me, it's different. If I'm not there for like 3 days on the trot, you know, on the fourth day, you know, just little things just won't be there.
So when this place opened up, when Cave Cocon opened up,
I
said, oh great, so it will split its time between the two and there'll be little elements of Josh food in here. Actually, it's, you know, the restaurant feeds the bar sometimes, as in you provide the food, but is that why it was so important that you could have a business that essentially runs itself, because you can't leave your baby?
Well, it had to run itself, and I've been very lucky with the staff I've got here, actually. So I've got a gentleman called Ian who runs the bar, who knows everything there is about wine, and he basically just runs it as his own. Obviously, you know, the offering is everything, and, you know, I'm very into natural wines, and I love hams and cheeses, and that's what we serve. It basically serves everything I like to eat on my day off. And so I've basically created a bar...
to serve yourself.
To serve myself on night times and days off, and that's what it's here for, really. And also, as I said earlier to you off air, Cochon, whenever you have a restaurant that does a really fine dining offering, it never makes anyone, you know, a vast amount of money, because it takes a huge amount of staff and expensive ingredients, and that's just a fact. It's always going to be a glory project. Anyone who's listened to this and think, oh, I'll open a restaurant and do fine dining food and become rich, that's bollocks. It ain't gonna happen. So I wanted to open something else which is a lot more casual, where, you know, it can generate a lot of profit. You know, that's just being honest, you know, about it. And that's what Carte de Cochon does, yeah.
You've established yourself as the restaurant. You decide to open up a bar. How does that vision of the bar come about? Because I want to come onto your vision for the restaurant later, but how does the vision for here come about?
Well, Vicky started to train to be a sommelier, and wine has been a massive thing at the restaurant. Comes back to influence of Paris. Suddenly, all the restaurants which I took inspiration from started to open wine bars, for the same reason what I just said, I'm guessing, to generate profit, stuff like that. And me and Vicky, you know, regardless of what you say, you're here to make money in somewhere. You know, me and Vicky like to go on holidays. And so, essentially, this property came up. Well, actually, my landlord at the restaurant, I said, if anywhere comes up, can you just let me know that we want to open a bar maybe in 2 years? He goes, well, I've got a property now. Do you want to have it? And me, I just jumped straight in, and here we are. And, you know, I think it's good for York. You know, I mean, once again, it's very different in here. You know, it's not like I'm serving average stuff. I'm serving, you know, hams and cheeses imported straight from France and around the world. I'm serving wines which you can't find anywhere else in Yorkshire. You know, I specifically, you know, source my wines exactly like I source my produce. And so, like, it's... You know, it makes a massive difference, you know, so it's really good here. Yeah, it's doing really well. I'm really proud of it.
So your partner's name's come up a few times in the conversation.
Yeah.
Is it important that you're both involved in the restaurant?
It's why we're as good as we are and why we're successful as we are. I think that me and Vicky do it together. I mean, obviously, I'm sure everyone listening, God, how does he spend every day with his partner 24/7 basically?
But she is lovely.
She is lovely. Yes, she is lovely. Vicky is lovely.
She's a very nice person.
But yes, she's a very nice person. Vicky is the sort of, I'm sure everyone can hear by listening to me, is that I'm the frantic one. I'm the one who has, I think, at a million miles an hour, talk at a million miles an hour, have all these ideas, and Vicky's the one who settled me down, tamed me in a certain manner. And so we work very well together. We play off very well. And obviously, Vicky, having the wine knowledge she does, makes a massive difference.
Could you have any other business partner? Because I don't think you could.
No, you're right about that. I could lie and say yes. I did have a different business partner and a different project when I very first opened, which I'm no longer involved with. And it ended in, which everyone could guess, that I wanted my way, he wanted his way, and there was only one way it was going to go.
Yeah, I think I remember.
Yeah, so
bits about this.
Yeah, so it's like, I am like that. I understand myself.
Yeah.
You know, I understand it's my way or nothing, and it's good and bad. Vicky hates it. I'm not sure everybody who works for me hates it, but whatever. It's just, you know.
At least you're self-aware.
Yes, I'm self-aware of my faults.
Because I can be a pain in the arse to live. I always say to Amelia, I wouldn't want to live with me.
Yeah.
But at least, you know, hands up, honest about it.
Exactly. I try and take Vicky out enough that it's tolerable to live with me. So
yeah,
it's fine.
Maybe we shouldn't share the story on air that you're not going to take her to Fiverr. She's annoyed about that.
Exactly. Well, I'm taking this to San Sebastian in September.
Yes, I saw this.
So I'm taking her to Azark, and I'm taking her to Exabari.
Nice.
And then in January, I'm taking her to Manresa French Laundry.
Amazing.
So
she does okay.
She does all right, yeah. Good. She does all right, yeah.
You grew the vision together, or is it very much your vision and she assists?
No, it's completely our vision. So basically, me and Vicky met in France. I was working at a very high level private chalet, and she was a nurse out there, and I broke my leg and met her.
Was that through skiing or something like that, yeah?
Yeah, through skiing, yeah. I broke my leg skiing, and then I met her there. And then we moved to Klosters in Switzerland, and we're basically cooking for royal family and people like that, very high profile people. And she was serving and stuff like that. She's worked in the industry before. And then we, after that, we went to Paris for a bit because I wanted to show where I lived, like my inspiration. And then she got the bug as well and then came back. Went to work for Tommy Banks at Black Swan, and I went to work for Blind Swine, and basically opportunity came up, and then we came together. So it's completely me and Vicky's, like 50-50. You know, if Vicky doesn't like a dish, she'll tell me. If I don't like a wine, I'll tell her. I mean, it's fine, we don't take it personally. Well, I'll take it personally.
It cries for half an hour, and then exactly. Gets over it.
No, I get grumpy. If she doesn't like a dish that I really like, I'll get grumpy about it. And I'll probably still put it on. But she'll probably put on a wine that I didn't like, so it's fine.
One of the places we haven't touched upon too much is the place where your second dish comes on to. What caused you to move over to Australia, first of all, and then, like you say, you started in pot washing?
Yeah, so, like I said, I mean, I basically lost my licence drink driving when I was, like, 18. I lived in the countryside, and there was, like, I couldn't work, couldn't do anything. So me being a stupid 18-year-old, for the best answer for it would be to move to Australia, Sydney.
Of course.
Yeah. And so I went there pot washing and stuff like that. And I actually like had quite a nice life. I like lived at Bondi Beach and went to work. I worked in a cafe. I started to cook at the cafe as well. And I used to save the money and go to really nice restaurants in Sydney. I used to save the money and go. It was something me and my girlfriend at the time used to like to do. So we went to a restaurant called Mark. It's recently closed, actually, but it's by a chef called Mark Best. He's opened a new restaurant in Sydney, actually. And it was one of those meals that, once again, transforms my view on food. And Mark Restaurant still right now has a huge influence on me and on my food. And he did the hot and cold egg, which is actually on the menu And it's always on the menu at Le Kirchenberg, and that is from Alain Passard. It's the Alain Passard famous gold egg, and lots of chefs have different versions of it. Man Ray's a restaurant, David Kinch has one, Mark has one. David Tutain in Paris have eaten one, and obviously I have one. You know, there's like versions of it. And it's the perfect dish. I mean, literally, in my view, and a lot of chefs will say this, I think it's like a genius, perfect dish. I can't really credit it for my own. It's not, it's Alain Passard's genius there on show, but you've got the hot yolk, and then you've got the chives, and you've got a bit of cumin on there, a bit of sherry vinegar cream, sweet, sour, hot, cold, everything's going on, savoury. It's incredible. It's like, it literally, it's one of those, it literally was the biggest epiphany. You go, God, something so simple.
So small.
So small can be that good. And it's been at Le Kirchenberg now for about 2 years, and I can't see it ever coming off. It is literally perfection. And it's quite strange because, you know, it's not, we're starting a meal with a dish which isn't my own. But I think it symbolises the sort of meal you're about to have, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
you're starting with an egg, and then it's like sort of like, wow, like, you know, I say it's arpège egg on the menu, you know, when you get the menu after the meal. And so it's not like, hey, I go, oh, this is my arpège egg, because it's not. But yeah, I think it's probably the most perfect dish in the world.
Do you ever think about your legacy?
No, I don't. I don't care what people think about me.
But would you not like maybe the idea in 5, 6, 10 years' time, you've got chefs in York or beyond that have said, oh, I learnt this under Josh, and this is my homage to him? And
I think people should do it for themselves. That's what I did. I think people should cook for themselves. That's what I said earlier, you know, like, you're only letting yourself down. You are letting me down, but you're also letting yourself down. I think people should cook for themselves. You know, legacy is a hard thing, and it comes down to, like, people asking me, you know, do you want a Michelin star? Do you want 3 rosettes? Do you want to, like, be in the top of the Good Food Guide? Blah, 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 all these things. And what I always say, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if the Michelin exists or not. It doesn't matter if the Good Food Guide exists or not. Maybe it's irrelevant, because I'll go into work and do what I'm doing right now, even if they didn't exist. And so my ambition is never to, like, leave a legacy. My ambition is to do... I feel very fortunate being able to come into work every day and do what I like doing. And I still get... I still cook. I'm not really a businessman. I'm still a
chef. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I still get to cook every day, which is very important for me. I don't have any interest in doing the paperwork. I didn't do it. It's about, you know, legacy. You know, I don't care, you know. I do care a certain amount of things. Obviously, you know, it'd be great to have all those things to improve business. But really, does it matter? No, it doesn't.
Is it less important for somewhere in a city centre to have a Michelin star?
I tell you what, it's, as a business point of view, if, like, I won one this year, it would be incredible, because it'd be incredible on the point of business, because I'd be the first ever person in the history of York to do it. I'd be being able to do it in a location like that. You know, it would be an incredible achievement, and for business, it would be amazing, because it's always hard getting business when you're outside of London. That's basically any chef would, you know, from the outside of London will tell you that. So it's important for business, but that's about it for me.
So here's something which I was going to ask you a little bit later, but I'll ask it now because it seems to be quite prevalent. We've mentioned that, you know, you have a friendship with Tommy Banks, and we've mentioned obviously this arguments you can have around divisions and produce, but you've just been in a part of a Great British Menu.
Yeah.
I know we can't talk too much about it,
yeah,
but you've just spent however much time with 2 Michelin star chefs in their company all the time.
Yeah.
Did it not tempt you to change your opinion on Michelin stars? Because it's obviously so important to them, and they're your contemporaries.
Oh, well, I mean, I'll just be completely honest about it. I think I'm just as good as Tommy and Danny, you know, easily. I think my food...
Well, I think you are too, if it helps.
Yeah, thank you. I think the restaurant is just as good as House of Tide to Black Swan.
Game on.
Yeah, well, I know it sounds really arrogant to say, but I have to be arrogant in this situation. I don't wake up every day and go, I want Cochon to be one of the best restaurants in Yorkshire. I want it to be one of the best restaurants in England. And I get inspiration from all over the world. And I think right now what I do at Cochon is that. And I expect, just because I don't have those things right now, doesn't mean I don't expect to not have those things in the next 2 years. And The only reason I don't have those things right now is because I have a little restaurant next to a Chinese takeaway. On two floors, it's basically a converted house with very little money, no backers. That's the reason why I don't have those things. Like, oh, this is going to sound really fucking arrogant, but let's, here we go. You know, if you put me in a kitchen where I had 10 chefs in a big kitchen, I think I could do really big things. You know, maybe that one of those things, maybe that will happen one day. But I like owning completely my own business. And that's why I don't have backers and stuff like that. So it's a yin and a yang. Yeah, I have to deal with my tiny, shitty kitchen. But one day, you know, who knows, you know.
In fact, it's probably good to put this in perspective to people that aren't familiar with your restaurant.
Yeah.
I live in a tiny little one-bed flat in the city centre of Leeds. Your kitchen isn't much bigger than mine.
No, it's tiny. It's literally the smallest kitchen ever. And to do what we do, it takes incredible.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it takes incredible hard work. You know, if I don't ever get those things, it's only because of the size of the kitchen and the property. And that's not to say I don't love the restaurant, that's not to say I don't love my kitchen and love the space I have. I do. But by fucking God, was it an effort to get it to where it is right now. I mean, a lot of money, a lot of hard work.
Yeah. You might not necessarily right now have these accolades, but surely having the kitchen that you do encourages you to get the positive response from the diners.
Absolutely. It's like people coming to my house. That's the way people describe it. So we don't serve a menu at the restaurant, so when you walk in, it's completely blind. And a few reasons for that. Like I said, it's like coming to my house. So if you came to my house for a meal, you're not going to ask for a meal or even one cookie. You're just going to get one.
Have a menu ahead of time, please. Yeah,
exactly. And two, when people get menus, people get expectations of what they're going to receive, good and bad. Some people might go, oh, well, there's a tomato salad on. Well, some people might go, oh, I love tomatoes, and it really pumped up. And they might go, oh, well, I ate tomato salad at, you know, House of Tides, and it was delicious, and then eat my one and be like, oh, it wasn't as good as that. Whether it was or not, they get this expectation is bad. Or people go, oh, there's asparagus on, I hate asparagus. You know what I mean? And build themselves up to hate it. And when you're like serving dishes like mine, last night was served raw scallops with turnip ice cream. You know, if I put that on the menu, a lot of people just
turn their nose up.
So I just thought it was a really positive way to do it.
Something that happens though in other fields, so if you think about comedians, as they grow their name, the people that want to come and see them do come and see them. Is that not happening a little bit now with yourself? Or?
Yeah, I mean, we get a lot of different types of guests. Most people come now because they know the style of food I do and really enjoy it. You know, it's good value for money. You know, you can get good wines and, you know, the menu is not that expensive and it's, you know, it's just a good experience. Then you get other people who have some race day along, surprise, surprise, who just want to like come and eat and be seen.
That's something that's really dreaded in York, isn't it?
I hate it. So you get people in those days who just come to eat at Location of Vogue because they see it's like the place to be, like sit there and like act like assholes through it and don't really, they're not bothered about food, they just want to sit there and blah, blah, blah.
It's almost to say that they've been.
It's just like to say that they've been. And then you get people who, you know, might have read about me or, you know, read an interview or, you know, a newspaper article or heard that I was going to be on GBM and just want to come and meet me and say hi and stuff like that. That's fine. A lot of those people...
Like me?
Not like you. I mean, people who aren't into food at all, you know what I mean? Like, sort of like, you know...
Because I have spent services just cooing at you.
Yeah. I'll just say, like... It's a big treat for them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a massive, massive treat.
It is.
Yeah, exactly. So it might be their one meal where they go out and they want to come because they've seen me on something.
Yeah.
And that's nice. And that's
well,
nice.
After this, when this becomes the biggest selling podcast, you'll be full.
Yeah, exactly. So there's all sorts. There's all those little things like of different guests. And then you get some people who... guests, it's the hardest thing. It'd be easy to run a restaurant without guests. People give me money.
I'm trying to figure out how to monetize that concept.
The best nights are when everyone comes in and everyone's just there to enjoy themselves.
Yeah.
I also don't fucking like it when I get chefs in who I can always spot a shit chef, right? When they like sit down and I eat my food and then analyze every little mouthful, look up in the air, fucking hell, mate.
It's like tasting the wine, but with food. They're like swilling the plate around.
Oh, I mean, they've been cooking sausages that long, that saving their pennies up to come and eat mine, and then, you know, they get one of my dishes and, like, eat, you know, trying to have some fucking opinion on what I do. And it's like, Jesus Christ, it's like, I hate that. Why don't you just sit down and enjoy yourselves? Like, that's what I do when I go to a restaurant. I don't even think about how someone's cooked something. I just go, oh, it's a delicious bit of food, and I smash it with my wine. That's what I do. I don't sit there and go, oh, Vicky, how do you think they cook that well?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, maybe darling, they cook it sous vide. I was like, oh, yeah, I think he's sous vide it for like 2 minutes over.
Place it on the barbecue for 10 seconds before returning it to the grill.
Exactly, you know. I know at my restaurant we microwave the lamb, but, you know, like, it's like, piss off, just sit down and enjoy yourself. It's such a weird thing.
I have to say that's part of the reason why I've done a podcast rather than become like a food blogger. Everybody says, why don't you write about food? I'm not an expert on food. Mm. I'm an expert in eating out. I can sit down at a table and enjoy a meal. I'm bloody good at that.
Well, it's a nice thing, this podcast as well, because you get an honest opinion of someone like me. Like, food blogging is a weird thing. Like, every food blogger seems to, like, write nice things about everybody.
Yeah.
Do they ever go to a shit restaurant?
I wonder why, because they've bloody, you know, they've been paid to do it. And
yeah.
I couldn't, in my mind, go to somewhere that they've paid me and go, do you know what? This was crap. Because at the end of the day, it's just someone like yourself who's trying and trying to do something. You should educate me.
Yes.
And I should enjoy it.
As well, when someone comes to mind, they might not love everything. Does that mean it's a shit meal? No. Does it mean that dish that you didn't like wasn't nice? No. It's just like, I don't, you know.
It's personal preference.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's a weird thing. I don't like people, like, just have an opinion about it. As well, if you didn't like my dish, say it was shit. Write it was shit. Don't not write it because you think I'll get upset about it.
Yeah.
I will get upset about it.
Sensitive soul.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me about the next dish on your menu then.
Okay, so you've got Duck Three Ways at Astrant in Paris. It's 3 Michelin star. It was Vicky's first 3-star experience. And I put the Duck Three Ways as a dish because it was my favourite dish there. But as a whole, it influenced me on my Asian flavours. So there is, I wouldn't say it's fusion, it's French, but, you know, he will use things like dashi and, you know, bonito flakes, you know, rice wine vinegar, things like that. And it once again was a revelation, you know, to go, wow, because fusion is a bit of a dirty word in cuisine, so, you know, no one likes to use it, but when it's used right and you get a knowledge of what you're doing, it can be fantastic. And then you start using Japanese techniques. You start getting confident using a lot of raw fish and things like that, you know. And knife skills of, like, the way the Japanese, like, cut fish is fascinating. And when you start to add that onto your repertoire on top of classical French cuisine, that's when, once again, when Cochon changed a lot when we ate there. Because I went, oh, well, actually, you compare, you know, XO sauce with squab. And, you know, and that's what happens.
It's that light bulb moment.
Yeah, it's the light bulb moment. It's also how, you know, when you see someone else do it, it gives you the confidence to have a go at it. I don't have any great knowledge in Asian cooking, you know, apart from eating at the takeaway. You know, so before I ate there, it was very just straight, like, meat, sauce, vegetables. But then when I started to add these different layers in, you know, it, like, elevated my cuisine, essentially.
One of the things you've done which I really like with your menu is you've titled it like a proper menu.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned before that you don't put a menu ahead of time, but do you still think about the titles of the dish? And
yeah, I mean, I think about the way the menu will eat, if that makes sense. So it always starts with the egg, and then after that egg, you will always have an oyster, because I love the saline sort of flavour, and the flavour of the oyster, and it washes your mouth, and I think it's a really nice thing to start the menu with, and you have the oyster. Then you have a set of snacks. The reason why, and the snacks will change, and that's where the black pudding macaroon comes in, but the snacks will always change depending on what we have. But that's always on the menu because I want it to be like tapas, and that's memories of invoking conversation. So I want people then to build up the room and have a conversation, like, what's this, what's this? And like, build it up. And then after that, we always serve something raw, which I like to use rosé veal, because I think it's an unused product. So we always have some sort of raw dish then. And then you always have bread. the start of the meal is sort of always fixed in a sort of way.
Yeah.
Then you always have our bread with homemade butters and homemade salt. And then the way it always works then, you always have, I try and do a vegetable course because, you know, my ethos is working with vegetables and working seasonally. So we show that off in a very simple way, you know. We don't do a lot of the vegetables we're serving quite interestingly. And it's always fish in some description. Often fish with a lot of vegetables again, so maybe carrots with some lobster, English lobster or whatever. And then we'll have some protein for the next course, which we do work seasonally again. So, you know, we try and put a lot of lamb on at this time of the year. And then during game season, there's always game on. And then you move on to your dessert, which will be whatever's in season. So right now we're using Gargette strawberries. People come in and go, well, how the fuck do you have fucking strawberries on not this season? Well, they are in pounds, mate. So,
that's but that comes back, yeah, that comes back to what you're talking about earlier.
And then we finish always with a sweet egg. So it goes for...
It comes complete circle.
Yeah, maybe some version of a sweet egg.
So, where's that come from then? Is that just come from trying and testing, or is that like a winning formula you've created? Or
the egg?
Well, I mean the menu.
Well, the menu. Yeah, that's just from working for 3.5 years now of, this is the best way of what we do.
Yeah.
It's once again, lots of people can serve good food. Lots of people can do good service. I think where a really, what makes you unique is giving you an experience, and that's what, you know, so that format now is giving you the whole package.
You're quite into your martial arts and MMA. I wondered if it was a little bit, you know when to attack, know when to defend, know when, is it kind of like a sparring match between you and the...
I'll tell you, actually, I am into UFC and fighting and stuff like that. That's what I'm doing this afternoon. and that sort of discipline, a lot of, like, I do take a lot of influence from that, but the most influence I have with my food is a jazz artist called Miles Davis, probably the best jazz artist in my opinion to ever lived. And so when you first come in, you get a menu. We don't get a menu. You get a little piece of card saying menu of erg, £60, cheese option, however much that is, coffee option, however much that is. And then above that, it says, I'll play it first, and I'll tell you what it is later. And basically I have a lot of... So it's basically saying, I'll cook it and then I'll tell you what it is later. Yeah. And his frantic nature of music is a bit like what we do. You know, another quote of his is that do not fear mistakes because there are none. And that's what we do. You know, we get really good produce. If you know what you're doing, get really good produce, there is no mistakes because produce is going to sink. Some dishes might work better than the others, you know, but like, that's a massive inspiration. Anyway, jazz music, you know, is a huge inspiration for what we do. Yeah.
I can complete. And also, again, it's something that completely is creative and it's has the forms can change so much.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. When a jazz musician plays one night, the next night he plays exactly the same song, but might play it completely different. The set might play, the drummer might lead it differently. Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. Like, the produce... Like I said, we serve what's best that day, not what's best that season, what's best that day. So if what's best that day means we have to change the dish, that's what
slightly. Platings of the dishes. So if you've essentially got from one day to the next the same dish, but you've got one slightly different ingredient because of that product, do you plate it up differently?
I plate every dish up differently every time. I don't give two shits about that. I think that's stupid. I think that's Michelin madness right there. Right?
Really?
Yeah, I don't see...
Oh, that's so interesting, because my next question was going to be, I remember that first time I came in, these plates just looking beautiful, and then despite your business growing and developing, I came in a little bit more recently, and again, the plates just look absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, obviously my plates look beautiful, I'll do that, but that's not to say that I'll put the sauce in exactly the same place each time. I do it where, you know, every time we might do a bit of lamb or whatever, a piece of meat might look a little bit differently. And if it looks beautiful and appealing on the plate, what does it matter? What does it matter? Why does it matter? You know, if Michelin put me down for that, well, then that's just complete nonsense. Because, like I often serve a salad, for instance, you know, it doesn't need to look the same. It doesn't taste the same. You know, let's rock and roll, you know what I mean? So that's what I think about it, yeah. But once again, ethos is, the jazz inspiration, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just my excuse.
done savoury on your menu.
Yeah.
We're now moving on to sweet.
Yeah.
Where does this next one come in?
So, chocolate ganache with salt, olive oil and pepper. This is from Avant Comptoir in Paris. So, first time in Paris, with me and Vicky, like I said, we went to restaurants and stuff like that. And at the time, that my like mindset was very much of a fine dining restaurant and food in general, at that level, it needs to be served in white tablecloths and silence. And that was my opinion on a sort of fine dining experience. Now, Avant Comptoir is actually a wine bar in Paris. And I have a huge influence on where we're sat right now as well. But Avant Comptoir and Comptoir, which is the restaurant which is attached to it, is very casual. And it's a set menu on a night time. And this is all the dishes. Just really simple and like no bullshit. You just cut away everything. Like, we sat outside and had really good cheeses and food, and it was like perfect. And then it showed me that it doesn't need to be like uptight. It doesn't need to be so up its own arse. Food should be fun. You know, you should come into the restaurant and have a good time. That's what you're coming for. You're not coming to like serve and then like sit in silence. Yeah. You know, you're supposed to like have a good time. And so it was a massive inspiration that, you know, I could do good food and have the confidence to play my jazz loud in the restaurant. You know, like everyone have a good time, you know, just like I didn't have to tell people to be quiet because table two were getting annoyed. You know?
Yeah.
Like, it has a massive impact on the feel of the restaurant. So, you know, that's why I put it on there. And, like, the chocolate ganache, once again, it was, like, so simple. You know, just, like, chocolate, olive oil, salt, pepper. Obviously, all things will work together classically. But, you know, I was sat there, standing up, eating this chocolate ganache with a glass of my sweet wine inside. You know, perfect.
Obviously, it's important that you've worked in these three Michelin stars to help with your cooking skills.
Yeah.
But do you think it was important to work in there to know, actually, that's not what I want to do, if you see what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. I have a really good friend, he's my old sous chef called Rab Adams, actually, Richard Adams. He has a little bakery in Leeds now, it's just called Roots. Well, he changed my food when he came and worked for me, because up until that, I worked by myself and I worked with other chefs with not the experience of Michelin. I think it's very important for chefs to go and work at that level so they have the discipline and know what it's like you said. So you either know you want to do three stars or not. So he like told me the story. He went to work at Gordon Ramsay's three star just so he could see what it was like. And he didn't much like it. He didn't hate it. He didn't much like it. He realised that, you know what, like, actually, I don't want to like a three star restaurant, you know. And that's what he sort of did for me. But I would say to chefs, you know, like, if you haven't worked to that level, like, I can tell, you know.
Yeah.
And that's not saying, like, you're going to be a bad cook or anything like that. It gives you different things. It gives you, like, organisation. It gives you just, like, pushing on and things like that. It gives you lots of chefs, you know, are, like, got big personalities like me and can be quite cocky. And I was cocky when I was 20. And to get it taken out of you is a good thing. It is a good thing. So it's not necessary. It's not necessary to work at a three star. But, you know, as a chef, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you travel? Why wouldn't you go to a different country? I always say, like, if you're a chef and, you know, that's what I said, like, in New York, there's not that many places to work. If you can't find a job, go and move. Go and learn your craft. Go and work in Spain, Copenhagen, France, doesn't matter. Just go work somewhere different. It makes you a better person as well when you're going to work with different cultures and cuisines, you know. I think it's really important for people to do that.
What I'm interested in is, if you take that advice, would you have opened up, if you open up Croque en Avregour, let's say it doesn't work, Cochon, Avregour, it doesn't work, would you have transported it to another city or would you have rethought your vision?
Well, when you open a restaurant, it's always a nerve-wracking experience. If it didn't work, I would have moved to France. And that was the plan. Me and Vicky were like, right, well, because we were in an R in whether to open the restaurant or to move to France.
Right, so it's one of the other bases.
That's what our plan was, yeah.
Oh, well, can I just say I'm so glad which is the one that you chose.
We said, we'll give it a year, and then if it doesn't work, then we'll like move to France. And that was like the idea behind it. And if it ever didn't work, I'd still move to France. And in fairness, like, one day I probably still will.
Yeah.
One day I probably still will, but I move to France and that'll be it. I have no...
So subtle hint, get into this restaurant while you can.
Yeah. I will say it right now, like, I'll run the restaurant for another 5 years and that'll be it. now I'll stop.
Right, okay, so I have to remind myself to get in a couple more times.
And that sounds like such a ridiculous thing to say, because lots of people go, you're so lucky you have it. But people don't realise the stress and the hard work what goes into it. We do 16 hours every bloody day, and, you know, people always go, people rip on people like someone like Jamie Oliver, right? Well, let me fucking tell you, if I got offered, like, a TV show with, like, lots of money, I would take it as well. Like, it's not...
You'd be stupid not to.
I hate it when people say that. It's like, oh, well...
I understand where it comes from, but I also understand, as you mentioned, more than any other profession maybe, apart from maybe, you know, your nurses, your emergency services.
Yeah.
It's a job where you can, especially at your level when you're opening up that restaurant, leave at 3 a.m. and be back in at 5.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a massive workload. And it doesn't get any easier when you get to where I am right now. It gets harder. I had this mad thought that it might get easier, and it doesn't. And, you know, I don't want to do it forever. That's that simple.
Well, can you just do it for a little bit longer?
Yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, I mean, five years is my cap.
For the rest of our sakes.
Yeah. And also, like, you know, I'll say this, like, now as well, because it's important for people to realise, is that, you know, me and Vicky are getting married, you know, we're going to want children at some point. We can't have children while this restaurant's still going.
Yes, yeah, I understand.
You know, and that's...
Not in the way that you run it.
Not in the way that we run it, yeah. And I don't want to run it any way differently. So there's going to be one day where me and Vicky's lives are going to change. And maybe at that point, you know, I might close Kosher and I might never cook again. I might close Kosher and, like, open something where I can just do it myself.
Yeah, you know? And come in and out.
And so right now, you know, I'm pushing on hard so that I can have a name for myself, that, you know, other opportunities might arise. That happens, you know.
Before we come to your last dish, there's just one thing which I wanted to ask you. We've kind of touched upon your time in Great British Menu, and two of the chefs that we've also mentioned in this interview, so Michael O'Hare, who you've worked under, Tommy Banks, who is a friend of yours, they've both found some level of fame through that. If fame comes knocking, are you ready for it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm quite a confident person. And, like, I'm very comfortable with with myself. I understand my bad points and some of my good points, but, you know, I like what I do. And so, look, I can tell you right now, like, when the show comes out, I'm the sort of character which will, like, you know, it's a double-edged sword a little bit. I think I'll grate on some people, and I think some people will like me. Not everyone can be as handsome as Tommy Banks and as lovely.
I was thought you were going to say as yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought you were going to say as handsome as me.
Honestly, I love that.
A good looking chap.
Yeah, well, thank you. I looked like Danny and Tommy's fucking child. They're both like 6'2", good looking men, you know, and I'm there, just like. You know, so, yeah, like, it doesn't bother me. Like,
do you think you'll find it weird though if all of a sudden you've got these press in your restaurant and
I mean, like,
seeing as someone you're trying to, in a way, the things that I've read about you, you're trying to discourage these stars, and obviously you would welcome it if it came along, but
yeah, it's like, honestly, it's not like certain things. I don't care if I get famous. I don't care about, like, you know, what people think of me in that way, because I'm just doing what I do.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that I don't care about having a Michelin star. You know, obviously I'd like one, because I think I just think I deserve one. Yeah, that's all I think. I just think I deserve it. You know, I think a lot of people when they eat at my restaurant, you know, don't understand why I don't have one. And that's just me saying it. And, like, if like, you know, I got famous, that's so weird saying it, you know, I don't think it would change me at all. Like,
because I hope not.
I've already got a big personality. I've already got massive opinions.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to mute it, you know.
Yeah.
Like, and if someone doesn't, you're only on this planet once, Christ. Like, have an opinion, have a thought. You know what I mean? I hate it when everyone, like, is just like, you know, all the same. Like, you know, me and Tommy get on because I don't bullshit around him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
you don't pander to him.
Yeah, I don't pander to him. It's just like, it's just my mate. You know what I mean? Like, I'm really good. I get on really well with Danny now that I've done the show with him. He's a really nice lad as well. And, like, it's just about, you know, cuisine and this sort of food is about sharing, having people around, having a good time, you know what I mean? Like, I would love having people around and cooking for them. And, like, I won't ever change, no matter what happens.
Good, I'm glad. Tell me about your last dish.
Okay, so hazelnut tart with cloudberries at Lake Road Kitchen in Cumbria. So, Lake Road Kitchen, I heard a lot about it from a lot of different people. And James Cross used to work at Noma. I think he used to work at Per Se in New York as well. And amazing pedigree, the CV. So anyway, I went to the restaurant, not thinking a lot, and James knew who I was and stuff like that, and had a chat. And I mean, by God, he's an intense man. But it blew me away. And I mean, I was going as far as it's one of the best meals I've had in my life ever at Lake Road Kitchen. And it was a massive inspiration to me because he was there running with his partner, Sally, just them two with like two extra staff, a bit like what me and Vicky do. And to have a meal as good as that, it sort of put me on notice.
Yeah.
It's sort of like...
You were like...
And it was just the product. The products were so bloody good. And like the cloudberries, I'd never seen them before, you know, let alone heard of them. And I ate, you know, he gave me this beef, which was 265-day aged beef, which he ages himself and he treats like blue cheese. You know, he's making his own miso there. He's foraging his own snails and he's got his own garden. He had a salad dish from his garden where he grew himself. The level of dedication which that guy put in, I mean, if there's anyone who deserves all the glory in this country right now, it's that guy, you know, and Sally, because it was, even there twice, three times, I don't remember. it's amazing. It is, like, amazing. Yeah, I think it's one of the best restaurants in England right now. And I like it because it's very similar to what I do.
Yeah.
He has a very similar ethos. You know, I get on with him very well. And I recommend it, yeah, I recommend there to everybody, yeah.
Evangelical about that place, I can tell.
Oh, I think it's fantastic. I think it's like really, really good. And it's a guy who, like me and Vicky, did it all by himself. You know, he doesn't have a backer. His dad comes in sometimes to pot wash. You know, it's all, when you eat it, it's all about sweat, tears, passion, you know what I mean? You just tell. Like,
not on the food.
Yeah, you can just tell, like,
yeah,
he really cares. This is, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what I like, you know.
So something I've asked guests to do to wrap up all the interviews, if you don't mind, is just one by one, just read me through your dishes. You don't have to go back over the stories. Yeah. Just to tell me what your menu was that you've chosen today.
Yeah.
And then pick your one favourite dish of your menu.
Okay, so we've got mousse marinière on the Oslo Harbour. We have egg, hot and cold, from Mark Restaurant Sydney, but originally from Alpège by Alain Ducasse. We have duck three ways from Astrance in Paris. We have chocolate ganache with salt, olive oil, pepper at Avant-Comtois in Paris. And we have hazelnut tart with cloudberries at Lake Road Kitchen in Cumbria. Wow, God, it's a hard one. It's a hard one to like pick a favourite one, mainly because I've sort of picked dishes, but I've mainly picked a meal memory of what's influenced, you know, the restaurant and where I am today. You know, I'm going to choose like the hot and cold egg. I'm going to choose that because that was where, it's a long time ago when I ate it, a long, long time ago. And you know, it's on the menu now. And it's been with me all this time, that sort of, and it sort of teaches you as well to keep it simple. It teaches you to like, it's sort of like the epitome of what I do at the restaurant. And bizarrely, it's not my dish. But I think it's quite a nice thing that it's not my dish. So it's sort of like, the crown, the trophy at the top, and that's what we want to be.
That's what you're aiming for.
Yeah, that's what we do every day, is that. So I think the, you know, egg chef road, as it says in Oeuf chef road in France, the egg hot and cold, yeah.
So I've loved hearing about your menu. Can only thank you so much.
Sorry.
I'm just going to wrap this up by saying, when you try and do these things, you obviously imagine who you're going to go to. And I've known about your restaurant for so long now that I really desperately wanted you on. In fact, I mentioned this project to you about, I think, years ago, that something that I wanted to do. And even back then, you said, yeah, I'm up for it.
Yeah.
And you've kindly given me your time.
Yes, okay.
And everything that comes to you, everything that will come, all the fame, any merits, anything that happens, I couldn't wish upon a more talented and nice chef. So I just thank you so, so, so much for taking part in the Past Podcast.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Josh Ovington, my guest on the Past Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Past Podcast is brought to you in association with Great British Chefs. Recipes, hints, tips, and features on this year's Great British Menu. Sign up for the mailing list at greatbritishchefs.com. I'm hoping to add some bonus content soon. So if you sign up to the mailing list, that'll be the best way for all your past podcast news.